Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 154 on July 1st, 2011. I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts this week, which meant I was three time zones away from my interview guest, Kate Harper, in Berkeley, California. Through a serendipitous route, Kate has arrived at some expertise in publishing content shorter than a Kindle single, and she simply calls these items articles. And my conversation with her led to some new insights into how ebooks continue to redefine how we write and read books.
Once I started helping people on the forums, I realized I knew a lot. So then I wrote the article on publishing articles on the Kindle. And then after that, I started doing articles on the greeting card design business.
In news, I'll be talking about another spiffy touchscreen challenger to the Kindle from Kobo and a Pew survey comparing the growth of e-readers versus the growth of tablet PC sales. Pretty surprising information in that. For the tech tip, I have reactions to the mysterious freeze-up on my previous Kindle 3G with special offers that I told you about last week. And in content, I'll have a warning about the Mickey Mantle title that I talked to you about. First up in news, I ordered a Kobo Touch Edition for $129, and it arrived this week. It's a sleek unit, even lighter than the Nook Simple Touch. The Kobo weighs in at 6.5 ounces on our kitchen scale, compared with 7 3/8 for the Nook and 8 1/4 for the Kindle 3G. The Kobo and Nook each have touch screens, and all three devices have the same dimensions to the reading screen, though they differ in the size of the overall reader because of design differences. The Kindle, of course, is longer because it has a physical keyboard. The Nook is wider and shorter than the Kobo. You can use the touch screen on the Nook to neatly advance the pages in what you're reading, but there are also physical buttons on the side of the Nook. I'm not sure why anyone would use them because the touch is so sensitive and pleasing to use to advance the pages. The Kobo opts for a cleaner design by having no physical buttons to advance the pages. The big difference in these three devices, in my opinion, is screen clarity. And to my eyes, the Kindle's e-ink display is sharper, clearer, and easier to read than the Nook's, which seems to have a fuzziness to the text. This is a slight advantage, and if you've never read on a Kindle, I bet you won't mind the clarity of the Nook. But compared with the Kobo, both the Nook and the Kindle have a lighter background to the text, which provides better contrast and readability. The Kobo looked to me murky compared to its two competitors. One thing I don't like about the Nook is the two-step process of bringing it back from sleep. You press the Nook button below the screen, and then you have to drag your finger across the bottom of the touch screen to unlock it, just like you do on an iPhone. With the Kobo and the Kindle, one button brings the display to life where you left off. On one count, the Kobo is the clear winner, and that's the feel of the back of it. The Kobo has a quilted pattern to its back cover that feels pleasant to hold. The Nook has a well-designed back as well with an indent in the center area, but the material is not quite as nice to hold as the Kobo's. The Kindle comes in third in ergonomics of back cover with a flat, hard plastic surface of no particular distinction. I used to think this was an unimportant design point because I've always had covers for my Kindles, but lately I'm seeing more and more Kindles in the wild without covers. Yesterday, taking the subway from Harvard to Park Street in Boston and back with my grandson to ride in the swan boats, we saw two Kindles on the subway. Neither one had a cover. The touch screens give the Nook and the Kobo a more modern look and feel than the now venerable Kindle 3, which came out last July. But in an informal speed test, I found that the Kindle has faster page turns than either of the challengers. It's a near instant advance when you press one of the physical buttons on the Kindle. The Nook, to my eye, appears to be slightly faster than the Kobo when you tap on the two screens on the left side or the right side to advance to the previous or next page. One deficiency of the Kobo that I came across is that on a free classic downloaded from Project Gutenberg, a Trollope novel, I was able to do highlights and notes on the Kindle and Nook, but not on the Kobo. A Kobo tech this morning confirmed that files purchased from the Kobo store are fully supported. Without appearing to pun intentionally, he said it's touch and go on files from anywhere else. I will say that it was very easy to reach Kobo tech support, by the way. I tried twice this morning, once because I was having trouble connecting connecting it to the Wi-Fi here at our home, and the second time for a follow-up session. You have to choose whether you want help in French or English, since Kobo is based in Canada, and then within a couple of menu choices in a minute or so, I was talking with a helpful and knowledgeable tech person. That's my normal experience calling Kindle support, very short wait times and excellent assistance with customer reps. By comparison, I just called Barnes & Noble earlier this morning for a question about the Nook and was greeted with a warning that due to high volume, they are experiencing unusually long wait times. I ended up waiting for more than 9 minutes before I got a hold of a rep. One thing I like about Kobo and Nook customer support systems is they don't ask you for your email and physical address every time the way they do at Kindle support. I suppose this gives some added security, but when I have a quick tech question, I appreciate it when the rep's first question to me is simply, how can I help you? So score a slight edge to Kobo and Nook over the Kindle on that one. Kobo is an attractive device, and their marketing has been lively and eye-catching based on emails I received from them, but I think Kobo is clearly not a major force in the ebook market at this point. If Kindle accounts for about 60% of reader and ebook sales, and the Nook has another 20%, I'm guessing Sony Reader might have 10%, and everyone else, including Kobo, divvies up that final 10%. After my initial experimentation with the Nook, I have settled back to my Kindle without much yearning for something new, even if it has touch. The slight advantage in screen readability on the Kindle is probably enough to trump the gee whiz appeal of the touch controls on both the Nook and the Kobo. For me, and when you add in all the other features of the Kindle, there's really no comparison. For example, you can highlight and take notes on the Nook, but you won't find those accessible anywhere on the web the way they are for the Kindle at kindle.amazon.com. Same for the Kobo. None of the Kindle rivals has text-to-speech or audible menu control, so they are non-starters for the blind and visually handicapped. Kindle has a much more robust publishing arm through Amazon's various new imprints, and although I know it's not everyone's cup of tea, I really like the special offers edition of the latest Kindle 3G, which is $25 cheaper than the same device without the offers. So far, the ads and offers are tasteful improvements on the stock images of famous authors, and I've saved enough money on the offers to pay for my latest Kindle. None of those advantages will be found on the Nook, Sony Reader, or Kobo. I guess what I want to pass along to you is that these new devices are attractive alternatives to the Kindle, but if you try one for any length of time, I seriously doubt you will find yourself tempted to switch reading platforms. And that's the case even if Kindle isn't improved with a Kindle 4 sometime this summer with its own touchscreen or who knows what else. I won't pretend to be unbiased when I consider these Kindle challengers, given how long I've devoted to learning and talking about the Kindle, but I'm not sponsored by Amazon or anyone else, and if I find an e-reader I like better than the Kindle, you'll be the first to know. So far, that hasn't happened. I will probably send my Kobo back for a refund and put the money toward my Amazon tablet fund, which I hope I'll be tapping in the very near future. For my second item in news this week, remember when the iPad was going to mean the end of the Kindle? Well, that didn't happen, and a Pew Internet Project survey released this week, in fact, shows that the increase in U.S. adults who own dedicated e-readers is outpacing the growth of tablet PCs. A PC Magazine story on the Pew study reported that adults who owned e-readers like Amazon's Kindle and Barnes & Noble's Nook doubled from 6% of the U.S. population in November 2010 to 12% in May 2011. That's according to a survey of 2,277 respondents aged 18 and over. It was a telephone survey. PC Magazine continues, over the same period, the share of adults who said they owned a tablet, such as Apple's iPad, grew as well, but by just 3 percentage points. About 5% of the respondents in an earlier Pew survey from November of last year said they owned a tablet, while 8% said they did in the most recent one, conducted between April 26 and May 22. Growth in tablet ownership seemed to be tailing off in the first 5 months of 2011, according to the research firm. About 7% of respondents to a January survey said they owned a tablet, meaning the increase in ownership between then and May was just a single percentage point, with a margin of error of plus or minus 2 percentage points. There was a healthy overlap in e-reader and tablet ownership, according to Pew. Some 3% of adults said they owned both devices, while 9% owned just an e-reader, and 5% said they only had a tablet. Forrester Research, I know, has been working on a survey on the same topic, but it looks like they've delayed their results until later this summer. It'll be interesting to see what they come up with on these same questions. Maybe all these reports of an Amazon tablet have led people to delay their purchases of a tablet until they see what the A-Tab will offer, like maybe free streaming movies, as has been reported in one rumor. Whatever the reason, this survey confirms my own impression in the field and from what I hear from you listeners to the podcast, that the Kindle and other dedicated e-readers will not be displaced anytime soon by multi-talented bright screen tablets, especially with another season of beach reading upon us. In response to last week's tech tip account of my frozen Kindle 3G that an Amazon rep told me I was putting to sleep too often manually, there was some useful commentary in the show notes at thekindlechronicles.com, so I'll refer you to that. Andris Bastin of the excellent Kindle World blog noted that she has been manually putting her Kindles to sleep for 3 years anytime she stops reading after she presses the home button to close the log files and make sure that her last page read in annotations are logged. Then because she puts it to sleep after that, no unintentional page turns happen when she picks it up. So that's a good reason for putting it to sleep, because if you wait for it to go to sleep itself, which is what the Kindle tech was telling me to do, you could conceivably have something, inadvertently hit one of the pages. Mike Perry suggested that the problem might lie with my restarting and quickly shutting down my Kindle. And I was doing that because if I didn't like the screensaver ad that showed up when I put the Kindle to sleep, I'd turn it back on and then put it to sleep again until I got something I liked to look at. And Mike said there might be background processes running after startup that are getting interrupted. That's an interesting aspect. Andris picked up on that in a separate comment, speculating on the possibility that my Kindle with special offers has some sort of monitoring aspect to its software, perhaps to let advertisers know how long their images are on the screen, and that I was running afoul of that when I was quickly putting my Kindle to sleep, waking it up, and then putting it to sleep again. The net of these comments is I think it's probably okay to put your Kindle to sleep manually, but I would still recommend against my earlier practice of rapid sleep and unsleep commands, which may actually have led to a permanent freeze-up of my 3G with special offers, the one that I returned to Amazon and got a replacement with. The new one's working fine, and I'm being a little more conservative in my sleep-unsleep habits. Kate Harper is a greeting card designer in Berkeley, California, and has worked in the greeting card industry for about 2 decades. She has recently been publishing articles about greeting cards and has passed along what she's learned in a very helpful 99-cent Kindle book titled How to Publish and Sell Your Article on the Kindle, 12 Tips for Short Documents. As she explained at the start of our conversation on Tuesday, July 28th, all of this Kindle publishing began with an article that she wrote which had nothing to do with greeting cards or publishing on the Kindle.
Started out with a travel article, actually.
And this is a travel article that you published for Kindle?
Yes.
What was that about?
It was about how to take advantage of cruise ship travel in a way that they don't want you to. So it was kind of like how to break the rules and have a good time.
Oh.
But I really didn't intend to sell it in terms of, I just did it for fun because I was trying to help my girlfriend publish her poetry book. And I wanted to run through the system just one time to see how it worked. And the article started selling. And I was so shocked that I went back and tried to, update it and make it look better and correct all the typos and stuff, because I thought, oh, my God, people are buying this.
So you did the book about cruise ships just as a way to learn the system so you could help your friend with her poetry book?
Right, but it was really just a 10-page article. So even though they call them books, I tried to make it real clear it was an article so nobody would be confused about it when they purchased it.
How long ago did you do this?
I put that one on Amazon last fall. Mm-hmm. And I really hadn't even looked at the results of sales till about 3 months later. And that's when I kind of panicked. Said, oh, my God.
What kind of sales were you seeing?
It started out very small, like about 10 a month. And then someone wrote to me, and, you know, I kept correcting it and updating it and adding more content. And he got involved. The person who wrote to me that told me, oh, you made this error, you know, this typo. And I was so appreciative. You know, of course, I corrected them and gave him a new copy. And then he suggested I include a better photo on my cover. And I said, well, I don't really have any more than the ones I have of me and my uncle. And he sent me a whole bunch of photos, actually, of his cruise. And I ended up using his photos for my cover and redid it.
What a riot.
Yeah.
Well, so the correcting thing fascinates me, because that question came up yesterday in the webinar. When you correct one of your articles, is it a pretty easy process? You simply pull down the old article and put up a new one?
Actually, the old article stays up. I guess you could unpublish it temporarily. But what I generally do is I just correct it and re-upload it, and it usually takes 2 days for the new article to, I guess you could call it overwrite the old one.
Mm-hmm.
But I have never really pulled one down unless, you know, something really terrible is in it, which that hasn't happened yet. Usually it's I'm adding a new link. I may correct something minor. But I usually try to check out everything so there's not something way off, you know, in the article.
And then once it's replaced in the system, it means that if someone buys the title after a certain point in time, they're going to get the new version.
Right. I really wish that Amazon actually went backwards so that everybody could get the new version. I know you've said that you've been able to do that in certain situations, but I have been actually disappointed that I've never found a way to do that. I wish I could send them and also get new versions of people's articles.
Yeah, that it's interesting to think from the writer's point of view what that process is like. Have you ever in the forums at Kindle Direct Publishing or elsewhere seeing if there's a way to do that, to go tell your
No, I haven't.
Because I have seen that happen. I have a feeling maybe it's on a case-by-case basis, and maybe it has to be kind of a major book before they'll actually contact the people that bought it and say there's a new version available.
Yeah, I will say that every time I've written to them, they're always responsive, but just the idea that I would have to do that is just one extra step I wouldn't go through normally.
Yeah.
But I will say, one point I lost an article completely. Like I upgraded to a new computer or something happened and my whole original article was gone. And I actually wrote to Amazon and said that, and they sent me you know, the original doc copy that I had uploaded.
<That's>
so
<great.
laughs> the service is really good.
They just always figure out a way to amaze you.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, so after the cruise ship article, what did you publish next?
After that, because I'd spent, let's see, after Christmas, the cruise ship article just flew off the charts. I think I was selling, God, several hundred. And I thought, you know what? I've learned so much by reading on the forums, reading shorts myself, helping people on the forums. And once I started helping people on the forums, I realized I knew a lot. So then I wrote the article on publishing articles on the Kindle. And then after that, I started doing articles on the greeting card design business.
When you say the forums, you're saying forums plural. It's not just the forum for the Kindle Direct Publishing?
Yeah, I read several forums on ebook publishing, I guess, would be the category.
Huh. What are do you remember some of the others other than KDP?
Yeah, there's the Mobile Read Forums is one. There's a Pubit Forum for the Nook.
Yeah.
It's not as active or in-depth as the other ones. There's also a lot of LinkedIn forums on ebooks, a lot.
Oh. So just if you look in LinkedIn and search for ebooks, you'll find some forums and people that can help you.
Yeah, and then there's, I have on my list, Let's Talk Kindle is one I read.
Mm-hmm.
I think the most active are the definitely the Amazon KDP and the Kindle board.
Oh, yeah, right. That's a good
one. Yeah.
What's your experience using the Pubit tool to format books for the Nook, the Barnes & Noble reader?
Very simple, almost the same. The image, I have had differences with image issues between the Kindle and Nook, but I mean, I can't remember hardly any differences. Of course, the form is a little different in the way you fill it out, but it's really simple.
But you basically can upload the same Word document to either tool?
Yes. Yes, it was very easy.
Wow, that's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Well, the article on writing articles, I imagine that one's doing even better than the cruise ship article.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that one surpassed that other one. I probably sell, with very little marketing, I will say, I probably sell about 500 a month at this point.
That's fabulous.
And, you know, it. After a while, I realized, well, you know, I should post on my greeting card blog that I have these greeting card books and stuff like that. And that's been really helpful for people because it's such a narrow topic. Most greeting card books are like craft books. There are very, very few books on the industry and how to succeed in it as a designer and make a living at it. Very few. I think there's actually one, really, that I would consider a book on that topic, and it's written in London. It's in fact, it's kind of a problem because all the numerical systems are in pounds. You know, sizes are different. So
what kind of Kindle books have you done in that niche of greeting cards?
I started out with one that people ask me about a lot, which is art licensing. So that's kind of like loaning art to companies temporarily, and you get royalties for that. And a lot of people just want to know all the steps you go through. Also, one on greeting card sentiments and how to write them, because they're very different than any other kind of writing. And then marketing's a big one, and I've written about some just basic tricks of marketing greeting cards or tips. And I have a whole list of ones I'm working on. You know, right now I'm working on a one on how to get sales reps for your greeting card line throughout the country. That's a big question people ask a lot.
Well, it's interesting because it sounds like you've taken a career in greeting cards, which existed before the Kindle and any of these readers even existed, and now they've given you just a new way to have leverage and impact based on the experience and skills you have.
Yes, it's really wonderful, and I get a lot of people writing me saying, you know, thank you so much for putting this in a Kindle, because the information's hard to find. And the funniest part of it is I'm really guilty of being making a lot of typos, even though I read it three times backwards. I'm just not trained as a writer. And what's hilarious is people will write me and give me a list of all the things wrong, and then they'll give me a 5-star rating. So the thing that baffled me is I thought, you know what? This is exactly like podcasts. When I first started listening to podcasts, when they came onto the scene many, many years ago, people were willing to listen to bad audio and terrible quality because the content was good.
Yeah, they and really cared about it.
Yeah, and this reminds me exactly of the same thing.
Well, and I heard from one, I think there's a Kindle Chronicles listener, Al McDermott, who gave you some feedback, and he told me that he was thrilled because you gave him some free copies of your book, and then he's actually written a couple of articles based on the help that you gave him. So
yes, and actually he really helped me because he made a whole list of typos that I could correct. And whenever people do that, I feel like, wow, I just got a free editor. You know, I definitely want to give them anything they want of mine that I've written. You know,
well, it really is like a community. It's I think that's part of the joy of it. And at least on the podcasting end, I haven't discovered how to unleash any revenue from it. But there's just the satisfaction of getting help from people and getting better because of it.
Yes, podcasts are a labor of love, and I really do wish there was an easier way for people to support them, because I've noticed podcasts offer something that radios just don't offer, and there's niche topics that would never get on a regular radio station. I remember listening to local podcasts where someone would say, oh, I saw that Steve Jobs just rented out a room in San Francisco yesterday, and that news on the podcast in the was before the news came out, like 3 days later, that he was going to give a press conference.
That's interesting.
And I would never know that otherwise. Hmm.
You can give people some confidence to experiment with publishing, especially articles. It doesn't sound like you were a web designer and a big expert in HTML and all that before you started dabbling in this.
You know, I actually did know, I do know HTML and CSS, and I have done all the different ways that you can do it to upload an article, and I found HTML actually the most complicated way. I know some people feel, you know, they like that better, but I don't think you have to do all that, especially in an article that's so short. There's no reason you'd have to use HTML.
And what is HTML? If you were going to explain it to a layman, what would you say?
If you want to put up a web page and you want to actually get right into the code, which is really good to know, because if you use an interface like Dreamweaver, it does a lot of things behind the scene you may not want, whereas you can go right into the code if you know HTML and correct things. Also, CSS is something that goes with HTML that helps you format style, so that you can change, like, all the headings to one color at once and that kind of thing.
Yeah. But in your article, the how to publish and sell your article on the Kindle 12 Tips for Short Documents, that basically walks people through from a Word document to the upload to Kindle.
In fact, I really encourage people to use Word documents. I can't think of a situation where you'd really want to use HTML, but I'm sure that there's people out there who would make a case for it. But I've even posted that on the forums, like, why would I want to use this?
Yeah.
And everyone says, we don't know why. So, you know, I think it's kind of like, are you a Giants fan or an A's fan, and that's what it comes down to.
The issue of short articles or articles versus books, short content versus long content, is interesting, because you've made the case in our email back and forth that there are a lot of advantages both for the author and the reader. What do you think the advantages are of the shorter content over the longer?
Well, the biggest one is the commitment to a book. And it, depending on your personality, buying a book that's 200 or 300 pages really says, look, I'm going to start at the beginning and go to the end. And that's a big commitment in time and just kind of the frame of mind you have to get in when you sit down to do that. Whereas I can read an article in an hour when I'm, you know, waiting in a waiting room somewhere, or I'm commuting, you know, to the city. Mm-hmm. So that's a big one. But also, the thing I found more often is that if I want to know a very specific topic, the one that comes to my mind right away is there was a book on how to price Kindle books. And it went in detail about how you would do that in what situations. And I've never seen anything like that in a regular publishing book on the Kindle. And I found that he knew a lot about this topic, and it helped me to be able to kind of dip into that and use it right away.
Was that, it sounds like maybe that was the book by Stephen Windwalker?
Yes. Yeah. And I really appreciated that, and it kind of opened up a whole bunch of ideas that I wanted to pursue. And I find that with my greeting card articles, too. You know, one person just wants to know about how can I write greeting card text. They don't really want to read a whole book on it because they're a writer. They don't want to read about how to design a card or, you know, how to market it. They just want to sell their text to companies.
It's interesting because as we're talking about it, it's another one of these places where the whole idea of the book is being bent by the possibilities of the technology. And what you're talking about is that where someone might have written a book about greeting cards and had chapters about all these specific things, now it's easier for you to put out what would have been a chapter and call it a book. And then it's easy for someone to find it, and they can find exactly the topic that they want. On the other side of it, my wife loves to read mysteries. And what she said is that, sort of on the macro end of the same spectrum, she almost treats a new book by an author that she likes as the next chapter of this huge book of their work that she's reading.
Absolutely, I agree with that. In fact, when I read fiction, I usually want a long book. I don't like to read short stories because I really want to get involved with the characters more.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like the purpose of a short story is really best to introduce an author, a new author who maybe I don't want to take a chance on buying their whole book, but I might pay 99 cents to read their short story,
mm-hmm.
which may get me to jump into their whole series of books.
Right.
So that's really, I agree with her on that.
Yeah, you've got kind of different modes of reading. The fiction is still the place where you want to get lost in the book and kind of disappear into it. But the nonfiction is still pretty much, it's a tool. You want to learn something useful so that you can do it.
And I think that what you just said earlier is a real important point, and I wish somebody would do research on it because I feel like it's happening, which is the whole idea of reading and what a book is changing, the whole definition of it, because I think publishers require books to be a certain length when they look at proposals. And so, especially for nonfiction, it's almost like you have to fill it with stuff. You have to have enough content. And now, I don't think that really matters anymore, and it's changing the way people read.
And it's probably changing the way people write, that if you see a topic that you want to jump on, you don't have to write a whole book about it. You can write a good, pithy article.
Well, you know, also, I was just thinking this morning, there, last year when we won the World Series in San Francisco, it was such a big deal. And if somebody would have written an article right at that time about one of the players, maybe, or the whole history of this specific team and what they've gone through, that would have been so timely to have done that. And I'm sure someone knows all that information, especially sports fans probably have a lot of great stories. And that's a great kind of example of how you could just put an article
right
up at the right time.
Yeah, it's so timely. You could, Christopher Hitchens kind of did that in his Bin Laden Kindle single that came out shortly after they killed him.
Yeah, I remember, and that's a perfect example. It's kind of like a news story,
mm-hmm.
But the articles I found, they go more in depth, and it doesn't feel like you're reading the newspaper. You know, it's really about stories about things.
Now, have you had any experience with Kindle singles where you've submitted a manuscript to land in that part of the Kindle store?
You know, I did submit one thing, and I did not hear back one way or the other. And so I'm not sure what's going on there. I do wish Amazon would at least respond. That's the only area I've ever felt that Amazon doesn't respond.
Yeah.
But I haven't really bugged them about it either. But I do feel like what they're looking for are short stories that are actually longer than articles. So they're like at 30, I think it's 30,000 and 90,000 words they're looking for.
Did you hear from anyone else in the forums as to other experiences with submissions to Kindle singles?
I couldn't find anyone. It's possible I missed something on the search, but when I put the question out there, no one had heard back. So I'm wondering if they're really looking for New Yorker kind of articles.
Yeah.
And you know, very professional writers and not us hackers.
Well, there are probably quite a large number of submissions, I would think, at this point.
Yeah, I don't blame them, but I'm not sure what the advantage is, except that you get to be in the category for singles.
Yeah, I think it's James McQuivey from Forrester. I saw he'd made a comment to someone that it may be a response to the problems they're having of what almost can be categorized as spam in the self-publishing area, because there are people really abusing the platform and having this kind of auto-robo-generated content. And the Kindle Single gives Amazon, I suppose, a way to have a place where they're curating what's up there pretty carefully.
And I wish they did have a place for articles, because it's not easy to find them on Amazon.
Yeah, that could be another category that they could have some quality control on. It's something shorter than a Kindle Single, but pretty much just in the article category.
Yeah, because I think that's the first place I would look, especially if I want to learn about something new, but I just want, you know, a short, in-depth article on the topic.
What would you name that category?
Articles, maybe.
Kindle articles. That's brilliant. That's brilliant. I think that could really work.
Yeah, because it's really hard to find them. I start by looking for a price and working backwards.
Yeah.
You know, I look for the cheapest thing and assume this probably isn't a long book, you know.
Mm-hmm. Have you had, there's a tool that I played around with, I think it's called Anthologize, where if you have a WordPress blog, it will create an ebook or something that you can use as an ebook out of a whole host of blog entries. But I found it very difficult. I never did see the project through because it was so buggy. But is that another way to get content into an ebook that you've played around with, just taking things from an existing blog?
Yes, in fact, that's how I made my greeting card articles. Is I have, you know, like 2 years of blog articles on the greeting card design business, and people would write to me and ask me, you know, how can I get a sales rep? And then I'd have to refer them to like 10 different articles I wrote on that topic. And over time I found, look, they just want all this information in one place. They don't want to have to go through each link and find the article and read it online. Package it up in an ebook, and I found that's what people really wanted. So I didn't even have to really rewrite much. Of course, when you have different blog articles, you kind of have to organize them so they flow more. But that was a really great idea.
Did you use any kind of a tool like Anthologize, or just cut and paste from the blogs themselves?
Just cut and paste. Yeah, just cut and paste. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've never heard of that tool. That's interesting. Huh.
Yeah, it looked very promising, and it sort of was working where I had posts that I wrote when we traveled to Africa, so I just picked the dates of those posts, and it looked like it was going to feed them in with the photos and everything, but I think that's a case where if I'd known some HTML, I could have cleaned it up, and it would have been a lot easier. But that's a
so
useful
way to do
it.
So how would it deal with the flow of the topic, though?
Well, I had written them sort of as a chronological, you know, a travelogue.
Oh, okay. That would work then.
Yeah. And I thought I would just have the chapter headings be dates, and then it would go like that. So
that might be one of the few kind of topics you could do that with.
Yeah.
A day by day calendar.
That's right. Because if it's more of a topical blog, you'd want to put some organization onto it to put it into a book format.
Maybe a seasonal cookbook or something might work, too, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, that's another place where I found Kindle articles would be great, are recipes, because I bring my Kindle into the kitchen all the time to look up a recipe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what's your next project on the Kindle?
Well, I'm working on the one about how to get a sales rep, which is how to get your cards into stores, and that's a big project. I didn't realize how much information there is, which actually is really wonderful about writing articles, is you can dive in and say, what's the important information, and not worry about the length, and just see how long this really needs to be. So I'm kind of going through the blog little by little and grouping topics together. I'll probably do one on legal issues around cards and design and, you know.
Now, and Amazon makes it pretty easy to, if someone wants to find what you've posted, they can just search on Kate Harper at Amazon, or is there an easier way to find your material that you've got for the Kindle?
Yeah, usually Kate Harper comes up, and then, of course, Amazon has the great author page, so you can just put all your stuff in one place, because I also have other stuff on Amazon that my manufacturers put up, like a calendar I have right now, that even though I didn't produce it, I designed it, and it's on Amazon, so I can add that to my book collection of things I've written.
I've been talking with Kate Harper, founder of Kate Harper Designs at kateharperdesigns.com. Thanks very much, Kate.
Thank you.
In content, I want to follow up my mention of a book that I talked about last week. It was a biography of Mickey Mantle, and it had enhanced content, which did some really neat things if you open it up on the iPad or some of the other non-Kindle device options for reading it. Andrus Bastin sent me an email pointing out that it's important for people to understand about these enhanced books that when you download them onto your Kindle device, you're going to be, it's going to be a much larger file than if it didn't have these enhancements. And I think what she saw in the Mickey Mantle book was that it was 495 megabytes, almost a gigabyte, and we only have 3.2 gigabytes for books on the latest Kindle. So, you know, you put a couple of those enhanced books on your Kindle to read them, thinking, oh, and it'll be neat because I can read the enhancements on the other hardware. You could find yourself bumping up against the limits of your otherwise completely adequate storage on the Kindle itself, and then sometimes things don't, you know, work the way they're supposed to. So thanks to Andrus for updating the information about enhanced Kindle books. In comments, add another one on the topic of the freezing of my Kindle. This one from Lauren in Florida, who wrote, I was dismayed to hear that Amazon, when you called them, recommended just shutting the lid on the Kindle, assuming you even have a lidded cover and not a sleeve or a naked Kindle. I think in many people's cases, there's a real need to use the sleep button, Lauren wrote. I mean, they put it there for a reason, right? In my case, I'm constantly putting it down and picking it up, and if the Kindle is awake, I'll hit a key and lose my space. Also, my small but very heavy pug walks all over things, and I need to have keys locked even when I'm not around the Kindle. Sometimes it's in my purse and needs the keys locked. I could list 100 scenarios. If this really is their new recommendation, I'm disappointed. I myself will continue to use the sleep button, and if it bricks, it bricks, and they can send me a new one. I hope this is a bug and that they'll fix that bug soon. It seems silly for them to recommend not using the sleep button when it's such an important button. Just my two cents worth. Well, as I said earlier, I think probably you're safe using that sleep button to protect your Kindle from your pug, Lauren, and just don't do what I was doing, which is sort of sleep on sleep, sleep on sleep. Bob Anderson emailed that he was intrigued by my question to David Burley of Overdrive about whether an entity other than a library could take advantage of Overdrive. He writes, obviously, it was not something he had been asked about before. It makes me wonder if, aside from a virtual library that anyone could use, and I wonder if there might be a way that libraries would merge their ebooks into a larger inventory, if a company would purchase the rights to ebooks and then rent them to a customer, who could then obtain the book faster than might be the case if he, she were to be put on a waiting list for the title. Also, Bob referred to my mention of James Bond books, which are available on the Kindle, but not the other platforms. He said, I have not read any of those books and have long since tired of the movies. I can't recall the last one I saw. But if you would want to try an author who would not ask you to suspend belief to the extent that Ian Fleming did, I highly recommend Daniel Silva. So that's a good one to check out, and he gives some reasons why Daniel Silva is worth a look, and I'll follow up on that. If you've heard something on the podcast you'd like to comment on, please consider leaving a comment at the show notes page, which is thekindlechronicles.com. You can also weigh in at the Facebook page. That's facebook.com/thereadingedge. You can also feel free to send me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com. I had a great time this week on June 27th presenting a webinar titled Formatting Content for E-Readers, hosted by the Professional Outdoor Media Association. It went the full hour with lots of questions, and I'll have a link to the recording of it in the show notes. I learned the limits of live streaming with QuickTime and a GoToWebinar format, but the rest of it went off without a hitch. Also, this week I saw an excellent O'Reilly Media webinar by Pete Myers on tools for creating ebooks, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. I had intended to record the POMA webinar and upload it as a TKC extra, as suggested in a comment by Mike Perry, but in the excitement of getting the webinar going, I forgot to start my recorder, so I didn't get that audio. So I'm sorry about that, Mike. This is Len Edgerly from Cambridge, Massachusetts for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.